Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. I'm also the creator of this podcast and your host. Today's show is another in the Why Read Lewis series that I post on occasion. The book explored today is The Great Divorce, a short work rich in meaning that is also enjoyable as a casual read. As with each show, I have a variety of guests reflecting on The Great Divorce to share why it is such a great book and why you should read it again and again. While there are many qualified to explore The Great Divorce, in the spirit of one of the messages in the book, I went with individuals less well known in the Lewis community. In fact, none of them have a published book on Lewis. However, I believe you will enjoy their insights from years of reading him. Those individuals are Dennis Beetz, Gina D'Alfonso, James Motter, and Britton Dickinson. At the end of the show, I'll give you brief biographical information about each. Briefly, before hearing from them, allow me to give some background on the book. While released in 1946, it was first available in weekly installments in The Guardian, much like the Screwtape Letters were. Also, Lewis wrote something important I want to point out from the preface. He said, quote, "I beg readers to remember that this is a fantasy. It has, of course, or I intended to have, a moral." He also stated, quote, "The last thing I wish is to arouse factual curiosity about the details of the afterworld." Close quote. To me, that means he's again emphasizing the fact that this is not trying to suggest this is what will actually happen. And now for those reflections. First up is Dennis Beetz.
When I first heard of The Great Divorce, someone described it as a day excursion from hell to heaven. And when I heard that, I thought it was a pretty ingenious premise, certainly enough to intrigue me into reading it. When I read it, it turned out that that isn't exactly what it was, though I still think that that's a good one-line description of it. It's close enough. What I actually found when I read it is that it was not a story of a day trip, but rather a trip of undetermined length. Because once the passengers get off the bus, they discover that if they choose, they can stay. And some simply take longer to make that choice than others. Lewis once wrote that there is no greater story than the salvation or damnation of a single human soul. And I don't know of anything he ever wrote that demonstrates the truth of that statement better than The Great Divorce. With one or two exceptions, each chapter is a vignette of a human soul choosing salvation or damnation. And in each case, the choice lies solely with the individual. And in each case, that choice is made in the presence of pretty persuasive encouragement to remain in heaven. Persuasion that is generally gentle and kind, though on occasion it can be explosively violent, yet still kind. When the riders get off the bus, most meet someone from their past. Someone already in heaven who encourages them to stay, but who also shows them quite clearly what they have chosen that has kept them from heaven. Choices and attitudes they have to release in order to remain and to progress higher onto the slopes of heaven. The story itself is told in the form of a dream. A dream in which it's very strongly suggested that Lewis himself is the dreamer. And he also meets someone from his past. He meets George MacDonald. And it's very informative, I think, how he describes MacDonald. MacDonald is the first of the what he refers to as solid people that he has looked at carefully. So when he meets MacDonald, he writes, "I had not yet looked one of the solid people in the face. Now, when I did so, one sees them with a kind of double vision. Here was an enthroned and shining God whose ageless spirit weighed upon mine like a burden of shining gold. And yet, at the very same moment, here was an old, weather-beaten man, one who might have been a shepherd, such a man as tourists think simple because he is honest, and neighbors think deep for the same reason. His eyes had the far-seeing look of one who has lived long in open, solitary places, and somehow I divined the network of wrinkles which must once have surrounded them before rebirth had washed them in immortality. In that brief passage, we see Lewis dealing with what I consider to be a very important theological point. He's describing a person who has been transfigured. He's dealing with transfiguration. In the double vision, he expresses the truth that in transfiguration, one is not merely transformed from one thing into another, leaving behind that which was. Transfiguration is a change, it's a lifting up that leaves nothing behind. The old is carried into the new and given its proper place. It is renewed, if you will. Lewis deals with this in other places, but nowhere with such eloquence and such clarity. And that's just one example of why the great divorce, I think, is so important. Every page, almost every paragraph, leads us into the heights of eternity and the depths of our humanity, and all of it contained within a light and entertaining fantasy.
Next is Gina D'Alfonso.
The Great Divorce is one of Lewis's books that I keep coming back to for the depth of the wisdom of it and the especially powerful way he combines wisdom and imagination in it. These are two things that Lewis is particularly well known for, wisdom and imagination. But there are certain books that to me have these qualities in special abundance, and The Great Divorce, I think, is one of them. To begin with, it's not about a divorce, not in the way that we think of a divorce. It has nothing to do with marriage and divorce. He's borrowing a line from William Blake, who talked about the marriage of heaven and hell, and Lewis is providing one of his own sort of twists on that idea. But to give a brief overview, to begin with, The Great Divorce has one of those great first lines that Lewis was so good at. I seem to be standing in a bus queue by the side of a long, mean street. He casts this as a vision, a person having a vision of being in a small, gray town, standing in a bus queue, and this bus is going to heaven. And we gradually learn, although it's sort of strongly implicated from the first, we gradually learn that the starting point was hell. These are people in hell, or possibly purgatory, but he sort of casts it as this might be purgatory for them, or it might end up being hell. But that's getting a little bit into it deeper than I want to go. But at any rate, they're in a place that any sane, rational person would want to leave, and they're taking a trip to heaven, which you would think is a place that anybody would want to go. But as we see from the experiences that these people have when they get to heaven, it's not always our rational, insane side that makes these decisions for us. These people are very driven by their lusts, their desires, their emotions, and they don't necessarily always want to stay in heaven. In this vision of the afterlife, so many things in this heaven flip our own ideas on their heads. And in some ways, for some of these ghosts, as Lewis calls them, who are visiting, it's all just too much. They can't take it. To begin with, there's the sheer size and weight and solidity of objects, objects as simple as grass and apples and sometimes even light. Everything in heaven has a peculiar size and weight to it, and it's just helping us to see how much realer things are in heaven than they are on earth, which of course is an inversion of the way we tend to think about things here in this life. We tend to think of heaven as a ghostly realm. It's all different there. Earthly things are ghostly there. Heavenly things are solid and real and heavy. And the spirits too, the spirits who are living in heaven, who have been saved and redeemed and live there, have a peculiar heightened reality of their own, and they make the visitors look like ghosts. So everything is sort of flipped upside down there, and it's not just the objects, it's a lot of the ideas too. As we go from story to story about what these people do when they get to heaven and what they see and what they learn, that there's a series of paradoxes that's almost reminiscent of G.K. Chesterton, which I think Lewis would have liked, as Chesterton was very influential on him. We have, for example, a mother whose only ideal, whose only desire is to see her son again. The sort of story that here on earth would be highly praised, idealized, held up as an example. And here, Lewis, being bold, dares to say that this mother, who only thinks of her son, loves him too little. It's not that she loves him too much. It's that she loves him too little. She's made him her idol. She's thrown away everything else for him, including her other members of her own family. And so Lewis dares to take a little bit of a poke, if you will, at the kind of mother love that we idealize, and suggest that there is a love that's even greater and deeper and more important. Other examples, we have the murderer who is in heaven with his murder victim. They both are saved. They both reside in heaven. And the murderer has been sent back to be a guide to one of the ghosts, who thinks that this is all very unfair. What is a murderer doing in heaven when he's been in hell? So that's another example of where Lewis takes everything that we've sort of absorbed, our own pathetic little systems, our own humanized ethics and ideals, and turns them all upside down, because in the heavenly economy, everything is different. Everything is about repentance and forgiveness. And so the murderer has made it to heaven ahead of the man who thinks that he did right all of his life. And there are so many more examples of this. For me, the line that sums it up comes from the murderer that I mentioned. When the ghost, who is angry at him, says that, he has his rights, and by rights, he should be in heaven and the murderer should be in hell. And the murderer tells him, I haven't got my rights, or I should not be here. You will not get yours either. You'll get something far better. And that something is God's love and grace that are far greater than we can ever imagine. And the Great Divorce is a wonderful reminder of those things.
Here's James Motter.
The question I have been asked to address is, why read The Great Divorce? I assume that most people hearing this podcast have already read it, and those who have read it only once might be somewhat confused by the book. So the real question is, why reread The Great Divorce? It is not about apologetics, or worldviews, or philosophical fallacies, which are the topics with which Lewis is most closely associated. Instead, The Great Divorce is about Lewis's theology. One reason for rereading this masterwork is that it was Lewis's personal favorite. When asked about this, he cited three books, Perelandra, Till We Have Faces, and The Great Divorce. It is a matter of debate as to which was truly his favorite, but he once said this, "If I had been forced to choose one favorite of all my books, The Great Divorce would have been my choice." He called it his Cinderella, which means in his mind, it was the one book of his that was most overlooked and undervalued. But like Cinderella, what a rare beauty it is. This fact alone should spark curiosity. Another reason for rereading The Great Divorce is that it is uncommonly rich in meaning. Anyone can read this book cover to cover in a couple of hours, but I teach a course on The Great Divorce which runs 8 hours. Now, either I talk very slowly or this book is far richer than first meets the eye. One can read this book solely as entertainment, as a theological fantasy. The storyline is simple. There's really not much of a plot. It is a series of seemingly random vignettes, and it has that endearing quality that a reader can enjoy it immensely and yet miss 90% of what the author is saying. But if it is solely entertainment you seek, there are better books. We read it instead for the light it sheds on Lewis's theology. Critics sometimes refer to the need to unpack a book. That's certainly true of The Great Divorce. I suspect every one of us who reads it for the first time is largely oblivious to the deeper vein of meaning. It is a book that is robust in imagery, rife with symbolism, and rich in meaning. You might even say it's dense, not because it's abstract or difficult to follow, but rather because there is just so much meaning buried deep within. How do I mean? Well, we could spend hours discussing who it is in real life that various characters in the book represent. Similarly, we could spend a few more hours discussing the meaning of the symbolic concepts Lewis employs in his design of the Grey Town. Virtually everything in this book has embedded meaning. I tell you, there is far more of this than you would ever believe. It is a book that rewards deep exploration, a book that pays repeat reading. This brings us to the most important reason to reread The Great Divorce. It is arguably Lewis's richest treasure trove of theological gems. People assume mere Christianity is the Lewis book that goes deepest into theology. In truth, it contains surprisingly little theology. It is in The Problem of Pain, and also in this little book, where he conveys more. Lewis accomplished this through the narrator's ongoing dialogues with his guide. Its dialectic technique is similar to Dante's Divine Comedy, only here, the narrator is the author, Lewis, and the guide is Lewis's literary mentor, George MacDonald. Nearly all Lewis aficionados are aware of the impact that MacDonald had on Lewis. He wrote about it in his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy. By reading MacDonald's Fantasties, Lewis discovered for the first time a sense of holiness. By any measure, MacDonald was pivotal to launching Lewis's faith journey. Most Narnians are also aware of the influence MacDonald had upon Lewis in the art of fairy genre writing, on Tolkien too. Lewis once said of MacDonald, "What he does best is fantasy that hovers between the allegorical and the mythopoeic, and this, in my opinion, he does better than any man." But few people, I think, realize that George MacDonald's greatest influence upon Lewis came in the formulation of his theology. Lewis spoke with reverence for his literary mentor in his preface to the MacDonald Anthology, where he said, "In making this collection, I was discharging a debt of justice. I have never concealed the fact that I regarded him as my master. Indeed, I fancy I have never written a book in which I did not quote from him." Is it not interesting to note that the epigraphs from both The Problem of Pain and The Great Divorce are quotes from George MacDonald? And they come not from Phantastes or Lilith, but from a series of books entitled Unspoken Sermons. I think one of the most important reasons for rereading The Great Divorce is that it can serve as a portal into this fascinating world of George MacDonald. I would caution you that there are misconceptions about this. For example, Lewis is sometimes accused of being a universalist, if only because MacDonald espoused such views. Lewis wanted universalism to be true, but in the final analysis he believed that it wasn't, as he pointedly confirmed in The Great Divorce. Now, it is true that MacDonald, even more than Lewis, was drawn to the idea of universal reconciliation. Moreover, MacDonald believed that Jesus would do so much for us that even the most damned soul could not possibly resist his efforts. But like Lewis, MacDonald understood that human souls have the final say in this matter, even if what they say is utter foolishness. The theological influence of MacDonald goes well beyond universalism. Lewis himself confirms MacDonald's broad influence upon his theology in this reflection from the MacDonald Anthology. This collection, as I have said, was designed not to revive MacDonald's literary reputation, but to spread his religious teaching. Hence, most of my extracts are taken from the 3 volumes of Unspoken Sermons. My own debt to this book is almost as great as one man can owe to another, and nearly all serious inquirers to whom I have introduced it acknowledge that it has given them great help, sometimes indispensable help, toward the very acceptance of the Christian faith. Perhaps Lewis's greatest testimonial to MacDonald was this. I dare not say that he is never in error, but to speak plainly, I know hardly any other writer who seems to be closer or more continually close to the spirit of Christ himself. That is where we all hope to be, as close to the spirit of Christ as possible. To that end, I sometimes wonder, what new ghost might be added to the roster of rogues that would reflect my own unique brand of sinfulness and recalcitrance? I wonder, too, am I willing to kill my sinful nature and to submit to transformation? Or will I, much like these damned fools in the story, resist the offer? Perhaps this Cinderella story is about all of us.
And finally, Bretton Dickinson.
One of my hopes for The Great Divorce is that it will become a Cinderella story of C.S. Lewis's works. It's certainly not his most popular. It's not where people go when they want to move from his fiction like Narnia or the science fiction work into some of his more serious or Christian or theological work. But I actually think it should come back up to the front of that conversation. And I would actually encourage people to read it before they read Mere Christianity, which is kind of like an apologetics work, or his essays, which are really like cultural criticism. Perhaps I'm being a bit selfish in this. I love The Great Divorce. It was really the first book I came to as an adult after having failed to kind of read Mere Christianity and after having loved Narnia as a kid, but not returned to it as an adult. And so I found so much benefit from this. And I also had the chance to read it in a different culture as I was working overseas, living in Japan. And we used it. I didn't even assign it, but somebody else assigned it. We used it as a teaching tool for English, for advanced English learning. It's a bit of a British book, but it gives an international language, and a lot of our teachers are American and Canadian, so it was a way of rounding that out. And each week we read a few paragraphs of The Great Divorce, and so I got to see this book just inches away from my face, right up close, so that I could look at it word by word and line by line and define it and to think about it in that very close reading kind of a way. And so for me, it's always been a fascinating book. And I probably read it once a year. Occasionally, I've read it twice. And so I hope that this will become a recovery book. But what draws me to it isn't just the fact that I had a great experience reading it. This actually is a book that grows richer for me each time I read it, including a little bit of frustration that I have with it. What I love about the book is that it comes out in a context where people were writing philosophical novellas. So these are books that are about as long as The Great Divorce, but are there to draw out a kind of conversational moment. And so this is a great period for these kinds of books, like Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea or Albert Camus' The Stranger, or The Outsider, it might be called. And so C.S. Lewis, whether he knew it or not, is writing into a tradition where people take a shorter story and they try out an idea. And here Lewis tries out a pretty brilliant idea, which is the question of what would happen if you got a chance to visit heaven? Would you want to stay? Our immediate answer is always, well, yes. Well, but that's probably the heaven that comes from our Hollywood films, or even worse, from our hymn book. It's not the kind of heaven that Lewis introduces. Lewis introduces us to the heaven of his imagination. And so it's a dangerous heaven, a place where reality is just too much. It's too difficult for us to cope with. The sun is too bright. The grass is too hard. The wind threatens to tear us apart like a dry leaf in fall. And so The Great Divorce draws us into this rich imaginative landscape that I think is actually among Lewis's best. So I actually put The Great Divorce, when it comes to describing context and telling the story of the landscape and the use of poetic beauty, I actually put this up with Till We Have Faces and The Paralandra. For me, The Great Divorce is right up there when it comes to the language. And in this book, he gets to try out, as philosophical novellas do, he gets to try out an idea. And it's that idea that I think is profound in its question. Now, a lot of people read it as the question of what happens to us after we die, about heaven and hell. C.S. Lewis opening up and giving people an opportunity to find space back to heaven if they haven't been Christian on earth, or if they haven't been able to remain faithful or even discover faith. Now, that may have been Lewis's view, but I don't think that's what this book is about. And actually, that he warns us in the beginning of the book, in the preface, not to read it that way, although maybe we should distrust that. Instead, I think what Lewis does that's really brilliant is he actually takes heaven and he takes hell. He takes the afterlife. And as much as we think as readers that we're being drawn into heaven and hell, what Lewis does is he takes the future, heaven and hell, and he actually draws it back into everyday life here on earth today, not just for the characters in the book, but for you and for me and for our neighbors and for our family and for our church. This is the thing that he does. And he actually draws the future back with him to the present. The future, which is, of course, unnamed, which is nameless, which is not complete. It's not a real entity yet. And yet, in our own despairs, in our own hopes, in our own ignorance, in our own knowledge, we'll often create this imagination of the future and then seal that in. I'm going to heaven, or I'm not going to heaven, or I'm going to hell, or I'll chance hell and see what happens when I get there. Those are the kinds of things that we do, but of course, the future doesn't exist yet. What's important in that sentence is the now, the choice that I make right now. And what Lewis does is take those future moments, the future imaginations of what that dangerous love of God is like in the great heaven above, and he takes it back into this moment and asks us the question of our heart. So that, are we living lives that have that openness to the Spirit and openness to our neighbor? And are we living lives of love and lives of self knowledge. A lot of the book is about self delusion, right? Are we living lives where we're open to the truth about ourselves now? Are we living lives of Christ's transformation in our hearts? And he draws that future back into the present, so we're challenged today with the question of how we live, of who we love, of what it is that we want to do in our world. And the reason he does this may actually be the kind of speculation that he asks us to avoid. The reason he does this is because I think in his imagination, it really is possible that when we get to heaven, we may not recognize it as heaven, but it might feel like some other place. And so he wants us to be ready. And I think that's the greatness of this philosophical novella. It's the greatness of Great Divorce. And so my hope is that in hearing this, that you'll pick up this book again, and that this book will actually start to slide to the front of the C.S. Lewis shelf.
And with that, I hope you are encouraged to read or reread The Great Divorce. I'm William O'Flaherty, and I appreciate you listening to my podcast, All About Jack, a feature of my website, EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. Today's show is a special feature from an occasional series I call Why Read Lewis. I do it in hopes that you will want to read more books by Lewis. Of course, most of my episodes focus on authors who have written about him, usually, but let's not lose sight, though, of the importance of reading him firsthand. Speaking of books, let me briefly remind you that I am the author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It is available online. Paperback is $14.99, and presently the Kindle version is just $5.49. Buying the book is a great way to help support my podcast. You can also learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. You can check the show notes for this and other links, including one to purchase the book you just heard about, along with links to other shows that my guests have been on. Speaking of my guests today, I told you I'd give you details about them here at the end. So in order of appearance, they are: Dennis Beetz is co-founder of the Memphis C.S. Lewis Society. He speaks on C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien and has published a number of articles on Lewis. Gina D'Alfonso is editor of Breakpoint.org and Dickens Blog. She is also the author of a new book for 2017 entitled One by One, Welcoming the Singles in Your Church. James Motter is a former management consultant from Atlanta who now teaches a series of seminars on the life and writings of C.S. Lewis under the banner of the C.S. Lewis Forum. And lastly, Brenton Dickinson is a university lecturer from Canada. He heads up the popular website, A Pilgrim in Narnia. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, the podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.